should be print. We'll check in with the abuelas and madres, see if they're using their own materials for the escrache. That'll help us get our final number, Mateo replied. I would learn that an escrache was a protest held outside the home of a political, military, or government figure found guilty of human rights abuses. People started chattering, and Sofia clapped her hands. All right, everybody, listen up. The escrache is Sunday. You know the drill. We'll meet here at 11 and leave no later than 11:30. We'll march from here to the church. We should arrive just as his congregation is leaving Mass, and then we confront him. Be loud, get in his face. But as always, non-violent. Any questions? What if it rains? Asked a teenage boy in skinny jeans and a Metallica t-shirt. His name was Alejandro, and he wore an old Nikon camera around his neck. A budding photographer, I thought. We're not canceling even if there's a hurricane, tonto, replied Sofia, lightly tapping the back of his head. He pretended to fall over, and the room erupted in laughter. It dawned on me that everyone around me had lost either one or both parents to the dictatorship. I recalled the reports I had just read and wondered if I had come across some of their parents' files. I looked at their faces, laughing or smiling. How did they manage to find humor in their lives? Filled with respect for these strangers, I nevertheless felt like an interloper. It was time to leave, but the room was crowded. I would have a hard time reaching the door without causing disruption, which would have made me feel even more uncomfortable. So I stayed still. Right before the meeting ended, Franco briefed the group on plans to make a presentation to an 11th grade class in the neighborhood of San Cristobal. As everyone in the room already knew, high schools around the country only presented the official story. The assigned textbook stopped on the date of the military coup, March 24, 1976, and picked up again only after the democratic elections of 1983. As the group discussed how to structure the presentation, Franco's voice became impassioned. One cannot and must not try to erase the past merely because it does not fit the present, he said, quoting Golda Meir, the former prime minister of Israel. Others responded with grave nods of agreement. As his briefing concluded, I caught Franco's eye and signaled that I was leaving. He gestured for me to wait. I nodded and stepped to the side of the room. On a table, I noticed a well-thumbed book with the words, Nunca Más, stenciled in capital letters on its dark red cover. It was the compilation of survivors' testimonies that Professor Torres had mentioned. I opened it and read the first page of the prologue. Thousands of human beings had been kidnapped, tortured, and assassinated by the armed forces. I slowly turned the pages. The typesetting was small, the pages dense with the words bravely spoken by the few who had survived their detentions. Do you want to borrow it? Franco asked, appearing beside me. May I? That would be great. I'll bring it back before I leave. Sure. Thanks so much for inviting me. No problem. But it probably didn't help much with your project, right? It did. I thought it was very interesting. And this book, I think it'll be really useful too, I said, holding the Nunca Más report up. Well, then. He looked at me with a shy smile. Listen, some of us are going to La Academia after we're finished here. It's a bar around the corner. Pool tables, reasonably priced beer, and decent empanadas. Do you want to come? I said, I'm pretty good at pool. Are you sure you want me to come? Even better, he replied, his blue eyes showing a twinkle I hadn't seen yet. It sounds like fun, but... Franco, can I talk to you for a minute? Sofia called out. Yes, he said, and then turned to me. Wait here. I'll be a minute. Okay, I said, but when his back was to me, I slipped out. The atmosphere at the Hijos meeting had been intense, and although Franco had invited me, I felt I had no business being there. Walking down the street toward a main avenue, I began gathering my thoughts. They were a fascinating group of people, unlike any other I had ever encountered.
What must it have been like to live under such circumstances, on the periphery of society, having to grow up before one's time?
A sharp contrast to the seemingly innocent lives of my friends back home. At a street corner, I realized I was still clutching the Nunca Mas report to my chest. It was a thick book, but I made it fit in my bag. While I was eager to spend the next couple of days going through the testimonies, I was also upset with myself for not accepting Franco's invitation. Maybe some of them would have shared their personal stories with me. Franco might have shared his story with me, too. At once, I felt I had let an opportunity slip away. I hadn't even actually declined to join him. A bit overwhelmed by what I had experienced, I had run off without properly saying goodbye or thanking him. During the meeting, so much had been going on around me, new faces, new ideas. But walking along the busy Avenida Callao, the air colder in the weakening late afternoon sun, I became conscious of one particular sensation blooming inside of me. It was surprising, but undeniable. I was attracted to Franco. My phone rang. Who could it be? Juan. I had forgotten about our plans for the evening. It was my second night in Buenos Aires, and we hadn't seen each other in over a month. The idea of going out with Juan was suddenly unappealing. I wanted time alone. I flipped open the phone, glanced at his name on the tiny screen, and proceeded to cancel our date. Chapter 14. January through February, 1974. Driving through Córdoba's rolling green countryside, Santiago would only release Valentina's hand when he had to change gears. She was glad to be out of the house.
Her mother had tried to keep her from going to the music festival, but her father had told her to let their daughter live her life.
Valentina wore cut-off jean shorts, and her feet were up on the dashboard. Her hair was in a ponytail, and strands of sun-lightened curls had come loose. It was summer. No homework, no being cooped up in her mother's seamstress shop. And the man she loved had come to get her. Smiling, she stuck her arm out the window, making waving motions in the warm wind. Abruptly, she yelled, "Turn here!" Santiago didn't see where he could possibly turn, but he obeyed and swerved the car off the road. A dirt path appeared among the tall grass.
"There's a river down there. My friends and I used to come here to swim. It's magical. You'll see."
They hiked downhill through the high grasses and trees. At the riverbank, they draped their clothes on big rocks. Hand in hand, they ventured into the cold water that flowed down from the mountains. Valentina let go, ran farther in, and dived into the dark water. When she didn't come back up, Santiago called out her name. Just when he was beginning to worry, her head resurfaced. A long arc of water squirted from her mouth like a fountain.
"Impressive."
"You haven't come in yet,"
she chided him, her arms cutting swiftly through the water to him. Her slicked back wet hair and smooth swim strokes made Santiago think of a mermaid.
"My body needs to adjust to the water temperature," he explained.
"Let me help you,"
she said, splashing him instead. He jumped back and turned to the shore. But then he swiveled around and started splashing her too, until, laughing, they fell into the icy water together. They had forgotten the towels in her duffel bag, so they dried off on the hot rocks, their faces turned to the sun. Lying beside the woman he loved in these pristine surroundings awakened in Santiago a sense of peace he had never experienced. He thought this could very well be his own little patch of paradise on earth. Using her hand to shield the sun from her eyes, Valentina grinned at him as if reading his thoughts.
"I knew you'd like it here." "What do you say we grow old in this place?" Santiago asked. "You could build us a cabin."
"In this unspoiled, beautiful spot?"
"Mm-hmm. Far from the chaos of the world."
"You sound like an old man,"
she said teasingly.
I'm not ready to settle down. Not yet. There's so much to see and do, Santiago.
He loved how she pronounced his name with that enchanting Córdoba lilt.
I guess we can wait, he said,
and reclined again on the rock. When they were dry, they put on their clothes and started back to the car. Valentina walked ahead, looking for the dirt path. They used their arms to brush the tall vegetation out of the way. Out of the corner of his eye, Santiago spotted something large, made of metal.
Valentina.
She came up behind to find him staring at a car on its side. It was a four-door Renault, the color red in the parts that had not been burned. They peered inside. Half expecting to find a charred body, they sighed with relief when they didn't.
Look at this.
Valentina crouched and pointed to holes that had shattered one of the windows.
These were made by bullets, right?
Santiago inspected them with his finger. Not sure how he would react if his instinct was correct, he walked around to the trunk. The lock had melted, making it impossible to pry open. If he only had a crowbar, he thought. But part of him didn't want to know what might be in the trunk.
We should report this, he said, returning to her side. To who? The police? No way. What if they had something to do with it? You have no idea how corrupt the Córdoba police are.
She took his hand.
Let's go. We're late to Cosquín as it is.
As they hiked up the hill to their car, she said,
There are no corpses. So they must have escaped.
Or they might even have jumped out before the car rolled down the hill.
Trying to find comfort in these unlikely scenarios, they got into Santiago's car and drove on. They found Máximo, Grace, and Enrique later that afternoon at a campground a few miles from the festival grounds. Enrique had his guitar out and was strumming the chords to a song by Mercedes Sosa. Grace kissed them hello, but was instantly drawn back to Enrique's playing. It took Santiago one glance to guess correctly that the two of them had become a couple. He considered Enrique a bit of a rabble-rouser, but Grace must have seen in him a sexy revolutionary, a close enough version of Che Guevara.
So glad to see you both, Máximo hugged them. How was your trip?
They had decided not to mention their encounter with the burned-out car. Valentina told the group that there seemed to be more police checkpoints than usual as they approached Cosquín. Enrique looked up from his guitar.
The cops are all over the place.
Why?
The government doesn't like the idea of thousands traveling to listen to communist songs performed by communists,
Máximo explained, and then he shook his head.
And we call ourselves a democracy.
Without interrupting his strumming, Enrique added,
The government is not in favor of music for the people.
And then his voice broke into a ditty.
Perón has abandoned el pueblo argentino. Santa Evita would never have done so.
The mountain air cooled as the sun grew lower, and sweaters, blankets, and ponchos were retrieved from backpacks. Grace served mate to the group, while Enrique fetched wood for a fire. Santiago, struggling to figure out how to set up the tent Valentina had brought, admired the ease with which Máximo had already finished pitching his own tent. With a bit of envy in his voice, he said,
You got that up quickly. That's how we Cassinis travel, my friend.
I grew up camping with my family, too.
We've visited a lot of the country that way,
Valentina told Máximo. It turned out the Quinteros and the Cassinis had stayed at the same camping grounds in Rio Negro and Neuquén. In their enthusiasm, calculating dates to see if they had overlapped while remembering some of their camping adventures and fiascos, they forgot about Santiago and left him wrestling with the poles, tarp, and stakes.
Can I help?
Máximo offered when they remembered him again.
I got it, Santiago said.
He had finally managed to keep the tent upright, and the group applauded. Sheepishly, Santiago accepted a mate from Grace. That night, Enrique's uncle, Augusto Medina, visited them at the campsite.
a guitarist and composer of Latin American folk music, he was lined up to play at the festival the following day. As the group gathered around, Augusto began strumming some of his compositions. Enrique brought out his guitar too, and an impromptu peña was born under the darkening skies. Valentina's voice harmonized beautifully with Enrique's, and Augusto said they should join him on stage the next time he performed in Buenos Aires. Valentina's body tingled from singing and from the offer.
I would love to sing with you again. Would you also consider coming one day to perform for the kids I work with at a daycare outside Buenos Aires? The kids would be thrilled, as would the nuns that run the place.
Augusto Medina agreed, saying he would be in touch. After the musician left the campsite, Valentina returned to Santiago's side.
You sounded amazing, Valentina, he said, with evident pride in his voice.
I wish I had learned to play the guitar, she replied.
The kids would enjoy having music be one of their activities. We should get you a guitar, he said.
She was excited, but her brow furrowed slightly as she contemplated the daunting task of learning an instrument. She had little free time as it was, and after the summer, in addition to her regular classwork and hours at Casa de los Niños, she would start working as a teacher's assistant. It was a prestigious position, awarded only to the top students in her program.
Or I could learn to play the guitar, and you sing, Santiago said, sensing her ambivalence.
You'd learn the guitar for me?
For you? Anything.
He wasn't serious about learning, but he also didn't want Valentina getting any ideas about Enrique Medina playing guitar for her charges at the daycare. As the evening wound down, Valentina noticed that Enrique's arm was around Grace.
That's a new development,
she remarked in a low voice to Máximo and Santiago.
They hit it off on our bus trip together, Máximo said. The three of us were going to share the tent, but it looks like they might want some privacy.
He got up.
I'm going to stretch my legs.
As he wandered away, Valentina whispered to Santiago,
Where will he sleep?
I feel bad for him. Can't he share our tent?
There's enough room.
Near them, a woman had been sitting quietly smoking cigarette after cigarette. She also rose and walked off in Maximo's direction, her straight hair swinging across the back of her poncho.
Don't worry about Máximo, Santiago said. He can fend for himself just fine.
They were the last two sitting around the bonfire, and they laid their heads on her backpack.
Are you comfortable?
He asked.
Yes.
It was their first time alone since arriving in Cosquín. They turned to each other and kissed for a long time, almost forgetting where they were.
Can I tell you a secret?
He asked in a soft voice.
What is it?
She said.
I've never been happier, and I am right here, right now.
Can I tell you a secret?
Yes.
I feel the exact same way.
He kissed the top of her head. Her hair retained the scent of the fresh lake water from their swim earlier that day.
You're shivering. Come closer.
Folding her petite frame into him, he wondered if his arms would always keep her warm and safe. Thoughts of dread and menace had been bubbling just below the surface of his mind.
Was it the death of her family friend? Was it the sit-in, where they had been violently separated and she had gotten cut and scraped?
The country was in turmoil, true, but he sensed it was more than that. His love made him protective of her in a way he had never experienced with anyone else. Sheltering her with his body, he wondered, would his adoration always be enough? His gaze drifted upward. The night sky had turned into a dazzling dome of infinite stars. Pointing up, Santiago said,
See how the stars have formed into the shape of a cupola?
It's like a cathedral, Valentina whispered.
That's right. Every time I see a sky like this one, I feel like it's the universe's way of showing us its sanctuary.
He whispered back,
I don't know. Does what I'm saying make sense?
I see what you mean, Santi,
He shifted his gaze from the stars to her face. He kissed her on the mouth and said,
I love you so much. I want us to never be apart.
It was nearing the end of February. Summer was drawing to a close. Perón's government stepped up its censorship of media outlets, and soon there would be no room for dissent, political humor, or criticism of the state. As a result, it was hard to come by accurate news. Yet the one news item that reached Constanza Larrea's ears was, in her opinion, true, because it came from a reliable source. Over a cup of tea, her girlfriend, whose husband was a higher-up in the Ministry of Education, had described the UBA School of Law, with its Marxist tendencies and infiltrators, as getting out of hand. Her husband, she said, wouldn't be surprised if there were some arrests in the near future. The news gave Constanza an idea, and she found herself practically grinning as she kissed her friend goodbye, thanking her for a lovely afternoon. Constanza's scheme made use of her oldest son Bautista's proposal to have Santiago travel with him on the European spring and summer polo circuit. A Saudi prince had recently poached one of Bautista's teammates, and the team was now short a man. Constanza had objected at first. Having one son away from home was hard enough. Having two sons on another continent was unimaginable. However, returning home from tea, she realized it might just be the way to remove Santiago from the political influences of the law school. She also hoped that an ocean between her son and that girl he was dating would help cool off the relationship.
We still need a player, Santi,
Bautista said that night at dinner, after his mother had told him in private that he had her blessing to bring up the trip again. The Larreas were dining on filet mignon, roasted potatoes, and a green salad. The team's patron, an amateur polo player from Madrid, wanted someone with Santiago's skills, Bautista added.
By the time you return to Buenos Aires, things will have settled down at the law school, Constanza said. With all the strikes and teacher absences, how can anyone study or pass an exam? Besides, your father can place a call to one of his friends at the university, if necessary, to facilitate the leave. You'll be representing Argentina at world-class tournaments, after all.
Santiago looked at his parents.
Really? I can take a few months off from school to go to Europe?
He asked, not quite believing what he was hearing. The new academic year would begin in early March, merely a week or two away.
Yes, really, Alfonso said. You can get a seat on Bautista's flight next weekend. Your mother and I would meet you there at some point. It would be nice to have the family together in Paris.
Bautista clapped Santiago's back.
It'll be the tour of a lifetime, baby brother.
Santiago ran his fingers through his hair, wondering about Valentina, when all of a sudden, he knew what to do. He smiled at his parents and brother.
Sounds good. Sure. I'll go with Bautista.
Excited to share his plan with Valentina, Santiago hurried to Café de las Artes the next day to meet her. She wanted to travel the world. This would be her opportunity. On his way, he made a stop, and when he walked through the café doors, he immediately spotted the back of her head. She was at their usual table. After kissing her hello, he rested a slim package atop the table. The elegant wrapping paper was secured with a strip of scotch tape and a sticker with a seal from Casa López, an upscale leather goods store.
What is it?
Open it.
He was barely able to contain his excitement. Santiago figured that if she agreed to go on this trip with him, she would be ready to settle down when they returned. Her wanderlust would be appeased. They could get married and have children. He might even propose marriage in Paris, he thought.
It's not my birthday, and Christmas was months ago, Valentina said,
picking up the package and feeling the weight of it in her hands. Santiago liked giving her presents, and though she protested, they were always exactly what she wanted. He knew her. He had never been able to come up to her room in the student residence, but he could picture it, with a few plants and the fresh flowers in a vase he gave to her every time he picked her up. There was also the record player he had bought her, so she could listen to the music of the Argentine rock groups they both liked, like Sui Generis and Luis Alberto Spinetta, as well as the folk music she loved so much. Valentina held up what appeared to be an oversized wallet. Her fingers ran over the tan, handcrafted leather that, when opened, revealed various pockets, some transparent.
"It's a passport holder," Santiago said eagerly.
"I don't have a passport."
"Not yet. I'm planning to get one, but..."
"Then we need to take care of that as soon as possible, because you and I are going to Europe."
"Are you crazy?"
Valentina exclaimed after he told her about the tour and his idea for them to go together.
"I can't afford that kind of luxury. I don't have the time or the money."
"I'll pay for everything," he said,
not yet having worked out those details. His parents would give him travel money, but it wouldn't cover both his and Valentina's expenses. He would receive a basic salary, but there would be no prize money, only prestige if they won any tournaments. While he tried to work out how to finance their trip in his head, Valentina spoke.
"My parents wouldn't allow it. It's tough enough for them having to support me. Remember that my mother wanted me to live at home and go to the National University of Cordoba."
He reached for her across the table. She had a point. Maybe it was too much to ask her to take all this time off, to fall behind on her studies, just so she could travel with him.
"All right. You'll come visit me, wherever I am, during the winter break."
"You'll be gone that long?"
Valentina's voice squeaked. She hadn't realized what kind of time commitment Santiago was talking about.
"Until September. Yes. Around the time when the season ends."
Valentina thought of the life she had created for herself in Buenos Aires.
"I have the kids at the daycare. And now that I'm a teacher's assistant, I'm sure I'll be working through the break, grading papers."
Santiago looked crushed.
"I thought you wanted to travel."
"I do. And I will. After I graduate, and when I've earned some money."
"I'll stay then. I won't go."
"Don't be silly. I can see on your face how excited you are, Santiago."
An ache began to form in her chest, even as she encouraged him to go. Busy as she was, they didn't necessarily see each other every day. But he was always nearby, and knowing that kept her heart humming with happiness. This would be different. They wouldn't be able to be at each other's side within minutes. He would be thousands of miles away.
"Not anymore, I'm not,"
he said. But canceling, telling his brother he couldn't go because of his girlfriend, didn't seem like the right answer either.
"We'll write each other letters. It'll be very romantic," she said,
feeling the ache spread across her chest. Grace entered the cafe, and seeing them, came to their table.
"Where's Enrique?"
Valentina asked after they kissed hello.
"He's at the airport, saying goodbye to his uncle Augusto,"
Grace said, taking an empty chair.
"He's moving with his family to Barcelona. Musicians have been getting death threats from the AAA.
Perón's Minister of Social Welfare, José López Rega, nicknamed the Sorcerer for his fascination with the occult, was the shadowy mastermind behind the creation of the Argentine Anti-Communist Alliance, or AAA. The paramilitary group was composed of former police and military men tasked with eliminating artists, intellectuals, politicians, students, historians, unionists, and members of the clergy with left-leaning ideas.
After we saw him in Cosquín, Augusto continued to play at small clubs around the country. He was arrested at a show in Tucumán," said Grace.
"They let him go. So that's good,"
Santiago said.
"Only after they brought him in for questioning and tortured him in jail."
The lovers momentarily set aside their troubles as they listened to their friend.
"He was released with the understanding that he wouldn't play or write another Marxist song again. To make sure, they beat his hands to a pulp."
"That's awful," Valentina cried out.
She remembered their night around the bonfire, listening to Augusto play and singing with him. Her stomach twisted.
How's Enrique?
He says the government won't win. They can't silence the voice of the people.
And you? Asked Santiago.
Me?
Grace asked, waving down a waiter.
I'll be better once I have a drink.
Santiago's mind was seized with an image of the musician's hand strumming the guitar, while it slowly became a bloody mass of swollen flesh. Horrified, he searched for Valentina's hand and interlaced her fingers with his. Chapter 15. August, 1998. The morning after my visit to the Human Rights Center, I went over my notes from Valentina Quintero's file. The desaparecida from Córdoba was a young architect. I pictured her at work on a new design for a home, an office building, or a school. She had been born in September of 1952 and had gone missing in April of 1976. Exact date uncertain. About a month after the military coup. At the time of her disappearance, she would have been 23 years old. Just 2 years older than me. Right before Franco surprised me in the archives room, I had scribbled down the address of Valentina's studio. I had also written the name of the building's superintendent, José Rivera, the last person to see Valentina alive. At a newspaper stand, I purchased a city guide and took a table at a café. I unfolded the map and studied the different colored segments of the capital city while drinking a steaming cup of café con leche. The address was in Almagro, a neighborhood west of the city center. I consulted the transportation options in the guide, and after paying for my coffee, I set out to see what else I could learn about Valentina Quintero. A bus got me to the neighborhood in about 20 minutes. After asking several people for directions, I located the building and rang the super's bell next to the splintered wooden door. The report had been filed in 1976, 22 years ago. It was a long shot, I knew, but one I would regret not pursuing. Anxiously, I chewed on the inside of my cheek until the door opened a crack.
Yes, said a plump young woman.
Hi, is José Rivera in?
Who wants to know?
The woman's hair was in a ponytail, and she wore leggings underneath an oversized black sweatshirt.
I'm a student from the United States, and I'm doing research about Argentina in the 1970s.
The woman gave me a wary look.
And what does that have to do with him?
I thought Mr. Rivera might be able to talk to me about someone who kept an office here many years ago.
I tried to look in, but the woman blocked my view.
Is he here?
The woman hesitated and said,
José Rivera's my father.
Really?
My enthusiasm was met with silence.
Let me introduce myself. My name's Paloma Larrea.
Marcela,
the woman offered reluctantly.
Very nice to meet you, Marcela.
Silence again.
I'm working on a project about a woman who was a tenant in this building, and I understand that your father was the last person to see her alive before she went missing. So if he's here, I would love to talk to him.
He died 2 months ago,
Marcela said flatly.
Oh, I'm so sorry for your loss.
The woman lowered her eyelids, accepting my condolences.
I'm sure this is a very difficult time for you and your family. But if it's not too much trouble, would you mind if I asked you a few questions?
The sounds of a wailing baby came from inside. Marcela turned back her head.
Is the baby yours?
I asked, hoping to draw her into a happier topic.
I'm sorry, but I have to go,
said Marcela, and abruptly shut the door.
Disappointed, I walked away.
My failure to get any new information on Valentina left me feeling off balance. I passed a flower stand and a kiosk that advertised international calling cards. Without any real direction or plan, I asked a kid locking his bike to a tree to point me back toward downtown. Avenida Santa Fe, one of the main city arteries known for its fashionable boutiques, was starkly different from the quiet residential street where Valentina had once kept her studio. Black and yellow cabs zipped in and out of traffic. Motorcycles whizzed by, at times so close that I could envision one of them jumping suddenly onto the sidewalk to skirt the traffic. Not a single rider wore a helmet. I waited at a red light next to an elderly couple. When the light changed, they leaned on each other and warily crossed the intersection. Children in school uniform ran by me in a swirl of shouts and laughter toward a small plaza with swings, slides, and monkey bars. Their mothers or nannies followed behind, chatting, one eye on their kids. As I got closer to the intersection of Santa Fe and Callao, another wide and popular avenue in the heart of the city, sidewalk cafes began to pop up. In spite of the chill in the air, the cafes brimmed with clients in warm coats and furs. A waiter in a red smoking jacket carried a tray with espressos, tiny croissants, and tea sandwiches above his head. He skillfully navigated the busy sidewalk and entered a clothing store. I stopped to admire the window display. The saleswoman, who looked like they'd walked out of the pages of Italian Vogue, flirted with the waiter while he handed each one of them their order. A dog walker wearing a red bandana as a headscarf led a pack of dogs of all types and sizes on multiple leashes. One of them, a terrier, stopped and rubbed up against my leg. I let the dog lick my hand and then watched the procession cross the avenue. On the other side, a few people were pasting large posters on a bus stop and billboard. I recognized a few faces from the hijos meeting: Mateo, Sofia, Alejandro, and Franco. As I approached, I saw that they were putting up the flyer denouncing the priest, Father Aznar. Their revisions had turned out well. It was an arresting image. They were busy, working quickly. Nobody noticed me. Franco was using his hands to flatten down one of the posters on a lamppost. Feeling somewhat nervous, I called out, "Hello!" Franco turned with a surprised look. "Hey! It's La Shanky!" He was in a dark blue peacoat, the kind a French sailor might have worn. "Paloma," I said. "Not that there's any reason why you should remember."
"Oh, I remember your name all right," he replied, adjusting his eyeglasses.
In the natural sunlight, Franco's blue eyes were more pronounced.
"It's just that I like to think of you as La Shanky."
The fact that Franco hadn't forgotten my name almost gave him a pass on the bothersome nickname. "The flyer looks good," I said. We admired the poster. Not fully satisfied with the result, Franco reached up to smooth out a wrinkle running across the priest's face. Alejandro snapped photos of the group with his Nikon.
"I'm sorry I left the other day without saying goodbye. I felt that I was getting in the way. I also needed to go."
"Don't worry. Americans are always in a hurry, aren't they?"
Franco asked, with what seemed like a trace of condescension, until he gave me a disarming smile.
"We Americans pride ourselves on being on time. If it seems like we're in a rush, it's because we don't want to be late to our next appointment,"
I replied in my best diplomatic voice, all the while asking myself how it was that some Argentine men could be charismatic and infuriating, all at the same time.
"Mateo came to say they were going to go down Avenida Callao toward Recoleta."
Franco picked up his satchel and slipped the strap over his head. Watching them collect their materials, I felt a twinge in my heart. Would I look back on this moment as another lost opportunity?
"Franco?"
In my mind, I clammed up, but my lips kept moving.
"Would you want to go out sometime? Get a coffee or a beer, maybe? I'm in Buenos Aires for a few more days. I mean, only if you're free."
When he didn't respond right away, I offered him a way out.
"You're probably busy. It's no big deal if you can't."
No. "A drink sounds nice. Why don't you write down your number for me?"
Suppressing a smile, I rooted around my purse for a pen and wrote my name and number on a blank page I ripped out of my notebook. Franco read my name out loud and then, with a deadpan expression, said,
"The name's Bonetti. Franco Bonetti."
Had he just pulled a James Bond move on me?
He was grinning.
I believe he might be flirting with me, I thought, returning his grin.
Before Franco caught up to his friends, he looked back over his shoulder and waved the paper. He mouthed the words, "I'll call you." Amazed by my boldness, I'd never asked a guy out before, I mouthed back, "Okay." And, resuming my walk down Avenida Santa Fe, I was filled with a lightness I hadn't felt since setting foot in Buenos Aires. Chapter 16. May, 1974. Valentina kept herself occupied in the weeks following Santiago's departure. Classes had grown more challenging as she advanced toward her degree. Her teaching assistant position was more demanding than she had expected, and the number of children in need of a meal appeared to have grown exponentially. It didn't leave her much time to think about Santiago. Until one night, while correcting papers, her bones began to ache. She crawled into bed and was unable to get up the next morning. Her throat burned, and it hurt to swallow the tea she heated on her hot plate. Lying in bed, she felt a hollow in her chest, one that only Santiago could fill. Argentina's postal system was notoriously unreliable, and, worried his letters would get lost within the student residence, Santiago had said he would try to mail them to her through her father's connections at some of the Argentine embassies. The letters would then be left with the doorman. Valentina could also stop by his family's apartment for a cup of tea with his mother once in a while if she liked, he had told her, hoping the two most important women in his life would become closer. Writing him daily made her feel better. She imagined him ripping open the envelope and sitting down immediately to answer her. Yet 1 month had passed since his last letter. Upset, she had decided to keep writing him, but to deliver the letters through his mother until she heard from him next.
"It's our awful postal service," Constanza would tell her during their short visits.
One afternoon, while drinking a coffee at Café de las Artes, Valentina felt her chest hollow out a little more. Rereading one of his three letters would provide some comfort, and she reached into her bag to pull them out. She chose the longest letter of the three and sat back in her chair. She had arrived late to the café for her study group to find several of her classmates at the table where she and Santiago had always sat. It was their table. The table where they had spent so many evenings. The table where he'd told her he was leaving for Europe. Whenever she came to the café, she intentionally avoided it. But after her classmates left, she remained seated there. The waiter brought her another café con leche, and she half-heartedly stirred a packet of sugar into the milky coffee. Staring at his empty chair, she placed her hand on the pendant around her neck and remembered how he told her he loved her. When she looked up next, Máximo was standing over her table, holding a beer.
"Hola, Valentina."
"Hey." He leaned down to kiss her cheek. "Why didn't you say something?" she asked.
"I didn't want to interrupt. You looked like you were deep in concentration."
"I was just reading a letter from Santiago," she said, slipping the sheet of paper into a book. He sat across from her.
"How is he? Conquering the old continent with his horse and mallet?"
"He's great."
No point in telling him or their friends that the last time she heard from him had been before autumn arrived to strip the trees bare of their leaves.
"I thought you would be at the Plaza de Mayo."
"I'm coming from there," he said, lighting a cigarette.
It was May 1st, International Workers' Day, and thousands had gathered at the square for Perón's address. In his 7 months as president, Perón had failed to control the radicalized factions of his party. In a speech from the balcony of the Casa Rosada, Perón had publicly taken sides by calling the far left stupid and unmanly. In response, hundreds of the young Peronistas abandoned the square. To the extent that anyone on the left still believed that Perón might pivot back toward their agenda, his May 1st speech shattered that illusion.
The walkout would mark the definitive rupture between Perón's ascendant right-wing supporters and the left-leaning elements he had rejected. Enrique came to their table.
We're going to the Villa. Father Oscar is going to give a talk.
Do you want to come? Máximo asked Valentina.
Sure. Valentina picked up her cup and took quick sips.
We'll catch up with you,
Máximo told Enrique.
Enrique left, and she asked,
Is Grace coming?
You didn't hear? They're no longer together.
Máximo frowned slightly as if he didn't like being the one to tell her, wondering why she didn't know.
Oh, that's too bad.
Valentina had been so completely submerged in her sadness that she had neglected her friend. The Villa, or shantytown, located by the central Retiro train station, was made up of structures built from a mishmash of brick, cement, and corrugated tin. Two men waved to Enrique, and he told Máximo and Valentina he would meet them at the chapel. The afternoon breeze carried the scent of carbon and grilled meats as they moved farther into the slum. Their sneakers squished in the mud. It had rained that morning, and some residents were still bailing out the water that had rushed into their homes. Valentina noticed that most buildings were painted in various colors. She supposed that, having run out of one color, the workers grabbed a can of whatever was available to continue painting. Some buildings were unfinished, exposing loose cables and rooms without walls, as if they had been bombed.
Dolores!
Valentina called out to a girl in a doorway.
What are you doing here?
Visiting my cousin, the girl said, waving back.
How do you know her?
Máximo asked.
I volunteer at a daycare. We get lots of little ones, but school-age kids like Dolores come after school.
Máximo studied her and then said,
I'm going to show you something.
He steered her toward a small building that looked deserted.
Enrique and I took this unoccupied place and transformed it into a space where kids can hang out to read, play, and think,
he explained while they climbed a flight of stairs.
We also tutor, help kids with their homework.
They entered a dimly lit room, brightened by painted murals on the walls, a family holding hands in a circle, the Argentine flag, children playing soccer, a freshly painted gigantic rose celebrating Mother's Day.
They're lovely. Who painted them?
Valentina asked.
The kids, with a bit of my help,
he said, as a few children ran up to them. The smallest one held his arms out for Máximo to pick him up. Tugging on Máximo's long wavy hair, he asked,
Did you bring me balloons?
Next week, buddy, he said, and patted the boy's small head.
What's with the balloons?
She asked him when the kids returned to their game of cards.
We combine all the birthdays that fall in the same month and throw a party. Enrique plays the guitar, and I'm the balloon man. Give me 4 balloons, and I can twist and bend them into any animal you like,
Máximo said,
his smile softening his serious expression. He seemed more at ease in this room with these kids than just about anywhere else. There was a bookshelf with some books and board games, a rug to sit on and read or play, a portable chalkboard, several desks and chairs. He went to a desk and tested it for wobbliness. Finding it sturdy, he nodded to himself, satisfied.
Did you build the desks?
And the chairs. They still need to be painted.
Valentina looked admiringly about the room, and then they said goodbye to the children. Outside, she said,
I love building things too.
Giving him a quick smile, she added,
You probably know that since I'm studying architecture. But what I love most is when what one builds fulfills more than one purpose. That's what you and Enrique have accomplished. You've built a space where kids can get away from their cramped living quarters to study and learn. But it's also a place where they can play and relax and be themselves. It's as if you've given them a room of their own.
Putting her arm on his shoulder, she said,
I like what you've done, Máximo. Very much.
He shook his head as if he were not deserving of the compliment.
There's so much more to be done, and yet we now know that nothing will change the way things are going with this government,
Maximo said. They reached the chapel at the same time as Father Oscar, who was in the company of another priest and three men, including Enrique. Enrique had been a teenager on a Catholic mission in one of the poorer provinces when he first met Father Oscar, and they often worked together in slums around the city. News of the impromptu mass had reached all corners of the shantytown. With no space left inside the one-room church, Valentina and Maximo stayed outside. Through the open doors, they heard the sermon. The priest reassured the parishioners that while they might feel like Perón had abandoned them, God never would. He talked about the importance of relying on each other and of remembering that a unified people could never be defeated. Everyone listened with somber faces. Even the local mutts had stopped barking, as if they too had been mesmerized by the priest's voice. Valentina and Maximo waited for Enrique in a small square by the chapel. The square glowed with colored bulbs resembling Christmas lights, but there were no trees here. The lights had been strung from the buildings, lending a festive air as people streamed out of the chapel. Enrique brought Father Oscar over to his friends. The priest had a handsome, open face, light brown hair, and eyes that conveyed empathy and compassion. If not for his cassock, one might have taken him for a doctor or therapist. The priests of Valentina's childhood had been old-fashioned and conservative. If Father Oscar had been her priest, she might not have stopped going to Mass, she thought, as they chatted. After thanking the priest for his sermon, Valentina prepared to leave. Maximo offered to walk her back to Retiro Station.
Thanks for inviting me, Valentina said as her bus pulled up. I found the priest's words so inspiring. I wish there was more I could do.
We have the kids' monthly birthday party next Thursday. We could always use an extra pair of hands, he said.
I'd love that.
And I'll help you paint those chairs, too, she said as she boarded the bus.
He gave a small wave when he saw her in a window seat. Waving back, she realized that Maximo asking for her help at the slum, his attentiveness, made her feel good. For the first time in a long time, the hole in her chest didn't ache.
Chapter 17 August, 1998. The art gallery on Arroyo Street was ready to close. The owner, however, had returned to the reception area to allow my father and me more time to take in the exhibit undisturbed. Dad had a press conference later, but he had come into Buenos Aires a few hours early to see me. Mom had stayed behind at the ranch with what she thought might be the onset of a migraine. The artist, whose work had been recommended to my father by his friends in the art world, was from the city of Mendoza. He became an overnight sensation when he was selected by an international committee as one of 30 up-and-coming artists under the age of 30. We walked on to another piece, but my mind was not on the art. It was on Dad, whom I had not seen since my most recent findings. It had been 5 days since Sanchez advised me to leave the past in the past, but how could I? The idea of my father as part of a resistance movement had exploded my preconceptions of him and captured my imagination. I tugged on Dad's sleeve.
Papa, I need to talk to you about something.
What is it? Have you seen Juan? You haven't mentioned him since I arrived.
Juan's fine.
Before he could ask anything else, and, more importantly, before I lost my courage, I said,
I know about the safe house.
He moved away from me to the next painting, but I could tell by his stiffening pose I had struck a nerve.
Please don't be upset, Papa. When we were at the campo, I visited Sanchez at his house our first night. And I don't remember exactly why it came up, but I told him I had met Grace, and he said he remembered her. And then he told me what you did.
Dad shook his head.
It's not his fault. I made him tell me. Please don't be mad at him.
He looked straight ahead at the painting.
And then, when I came to the city, I met the professor.
What professor?
The writer, Martin Torres. He teaches at UBA. You didn't know?
I hoped that this new piece of information might cause him to open up.
And this whole time I thought you had come to Buenos Aires to be with Juan,
he remarked with an ironic smile. Dad proceeded to the next painting. More jagged black slashes on a smooth white canvas, although this one was a smaller version.
Papa!
I followed him. I can't believe you never told me! For several moments, he didn't speak. When he looked at me, he said,
Don't take this the wrong way, my love. I'm sure you want to know everything. However, there are some things about my life that are mine, and that I don't have to share with you or anyone else.
But what you did was incredibly brave.
I'm not so sure,
he replied.
What about the note?
What note?
The one in your coat pocket.
His face darkened.
I found it when I was looking for your wallet. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to snoop. It fell out of your pocket.
He touched my arm.
It's okay. I'm the one who is sorry. This is all so unexpected. Forgive me.
He retrieved the artist's catalog and turned the pages until he found the photo and description of the work before him.
An old friend who wants to meet you at your usual café and won't take no for an answer.
I'm pretty sure that's what the note said. My hand rested on his arm.
Papa? What's that about? Who wrote it?
My father lifted his gaze from the catalog.
Come. Let's sit down for a minute,
he said, indicating a bench nearby. Once we were seated, he spoke again.
Paloma, when it comes to politics, in this country or in any other country, there are people who are on your side and people who aren't. That's the way it's always been. And when you have power, people hope to get something from you. They want your time or your gratitude if they think that you owe them something. Some demand it from you.
He put his hand under my chin and raised it so our eyes met.
Sweetheart, I don't want you to worry about me or anything else that has to do with my new position. All right?
All right,
I replied. Dad had dodged my question, but I didn't insist. I had more to find out.
Is that a promise?
It's a promise.
Good.
He kissed my forehead.
As for your other question, no one knew, and to this day, no one knows about the safe house, except for the few that we helped out.
I understand. I haven't said anything to anyone.
We sat in silence, and then I asked,
Why did you do it?
Any number of reasons, I suppose.
Professor Torres told me there was a rumor around that time that you built it because of a woman, an architect. He said that she had been important to you.
He said that?
He was unable to hide his surprise.
Yes. Who was she?
He was visibly distracted and didn't answer.
Papa, who was the architect?
You mean Valentina?
He gave me a nervous glance.
You really want to know?
Yes, please,
I said, smiling inwardly at having figured out the woman's name on my own. For a moment he was quiet.
She was someone I knew, many years ago.
He let out a low exhale.
Before I started seeing your mother. We dated when we were students.
I thought so, I said.
We broke up before we graduated. I met your mother not long after.
While he spoke, he folded and refolded the catalog.
Go on.
A few months after your mother and I were married, the military overthrew the government. Many knew it was coming, and honestly, to most people, it came as a relief. The country was a violent mess, and the junta was promising law and order. But we did not know that the new government would escalate the persecution that started under Perón. We were ignorant. Or maybe we didn't want to know or couldn't find out because the media was censored.
He tapped the rolled-up catalog against his thigh.
I saw Valentina a few times, right after the coup. We still knew people in common. I thought we could be friends. But when I understood she wanted us to get back together, I had to stop seeing her. One day, I heard she had gone missing.
He unfurled the catalog and stared at the cover.
Afterward, I found out that others were disappearing too.
I built a safe house at the campo, thinking that maybe I could help a few people. It wasn't much. Torres says you managed to get a lot of people out of the country. Pointing this out didn't seem to console my father, who looked crestfallen. Do you think Valentina might have escaped through some other channel? Maybe she's living elsewhere under a different name and identity. He shook his head once.
She would have come forward after the dictatorship collapsed. At the very least, she would have contacted her parents. There would have been no reason for her to continue hiding.
Dad seemed so despondent that I took his hand and said, Grace said you were a brave man, and that lives were saved thanks to you.
I don't know about that,
he said quietly.
I never told your mother about the safe house. I wanted to protect her, and I was never able to bring myself to tell her I had been in touch with Valentina after we were married. Your mother didn't really get along with her, understandably.
He smiled feebly.
Once we moved to the United States, I made a decision to leave it all behind, to start fresh.
His phone rang then. It was one of his new aides. The press conference was starting. Where was he? The aide was anxious to know. As we left the gallery, I said, Thanks, Papa.
For what?
For telling me. For trusting me with this. A block from Plaza San Martin, home to General San Martin's statue, and a meeting point for young and old alike, stood the historic Plaza Hotel. Bellboys bustled about, hailing taxis and ushering well-heeled guests through the doors. A member of my father's staff was waiting. He escorted us through the sumptuous lobby and up a marble staircase to the first floor. The press conference for the new UN ambassador had been scheduled in one of the rooms in the hotel's conference center. After a quick review of his notes, Dad was led to a podium in front of a group of a dozen or so waiting journalists and photographers. When Dad had delivered his remarks and was ready to take questions, my father's aide stepped forward to address the press.
Please give us your full name and affiliation before presenting your question.
Eduardo Perez, La Nación.
Ambassador Larrea, my question is the following. Will you make the reopening of beef exports one of your top priorities?
This is more of a question for my colleagues in the trade ministry, but I am confident that once the Americans have tasted our beef, they will soon be replacing their barbecues with our asados.
Even with a president who is famous for loving spare ribs with barbecue sauce?
Asked another journalist, drawing laughter from the room.
Absolutely.
I could tell Dad was enjoying himself.
Ambassador Larrea, why don't you tell us a little bit about your family?
My father's eyes swept the room in search of the reporter who had asked the question, winking at me when he spotted me. He was about to take another question when a man stepped out from behind a column and said,
Over here.
Dad looked at the pleasant-looking, blonde-haired